Case number 12-1238. Center for Biological Diversity et al. Petitioners versus Environmental Protection Agency et al. Mr. Bundy for the petitioners, Mr. Durkee for the respondents.
Thank you and good morning.
May it
please the court. My name is Kevin Bundy. I'm here on behalf of the petitioners, and I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal. The plain text of the Clean Air Act imposes a mandatory obligation on EPA to specify a level of air quality requisite to protect the public welfare. This court has held twice, in American Farm Bureau Federation and in Mississippi versus EPA, that EPA cannot avoid this plain and mandatory statutory duty.
I'm interested in whether you have standing or not. Not for the reasons necessarily set forth by the government, but I'm just not sure you've identified a wrong specific and personal to your petitioners that isn't a universal to be taken to the other branches of court government before the court of last resort. Well, what is the personal injury here that is to be redressed in this action?
Your Honor, our members have alleged personal, recreational, aesthetic, spiritual
injuries. I know
injuries.
They have, but the recreational and aesthetic cases generally deal with a specific location where there's some regulation that covers the Grand Canyon, and the petitioners say, well, we go to the Grand Canyon. Here, what you're going on is national ambient air quality standards, isn't it? Isn't that what we're talking about?
We are talking about a national standard, Your
right.
Honor. But
so that applies to everybody, right?
It's hurting
everybody, and that's the kind of thing you take to Congress or the executive.
A couple of responses, Your Honor. One, this standard actually does account for regional differences in the ability of ecosystems to absorb acidifying deposition. In other words, regional sensitivities. The record is replete with evidence that there are certain parts of the country that are more sensitive to acidic deposition than others. And the declarations that we've submitted with our opening brief.
Any case that says that where the alleged harm is universally shared, it's good enough for standing if you're a person who says, well, it's universally shared, but within the universe there's subsets or something like what you're arguing here?
No, Your Honor.
I really question whether you have standing.
I don't know of a case that says exactly what you say. Massachusetts versus EPA, the majority did.
I'm very aware of that.
Because I'm sure I know you're aware of that case. And the majority did say that there was a long footnote in that opinion expressing doubt about foreclosing standing merely based alone on the universal harm. But here, we're not really talking about universal harm.
Massachusetts in terms of widely felt harm as opposed to universally, didn't it?
Widely felt to the point where that being the sole criterion for denying standing, I think that's what the court was skeptical of.
The actual holding of Massachusetts is really, although I may disagree with it, is really in rather conventional standing terms. I mean, you get the state idea of state as in pari patriens against the federal, which is a brand new idea, but as far as standing concept, there's really nothing new made by Massachusetts, is there?
What I would say is that we're dealing with a different kind of harm in this case than the court was dealing with in Massachusetts versus EPA. Climate change is something that we're all going to experience, already experiencing. It is perhaps the most broadly felt harm you could imagine. Different people in different parts of this country, however, are going to be affected differently by acidic deposition because of the regional sensitivity or lack of sensitivity to acid precipitation. We have in our declarations, John Davis, Molly Madison both mention repeated visits to water bodies that are affected by acidic deposition, that are close to where they live, that they have been visiting for years. They have concrete intentions to keep visiting. And Elizabeth Norcross's declaration covers that same. These are in areas of the country that are.
We're probably not going to move the ball anymore on that subject. I'll let you alone on that.
I wanted to distinguish this and to draw your attention to those declarations where there are specific water bodies identified and recognizing those water bodies are affected by aquatic acidification. We would submit that that's a concrete and particularized injury for purposes of this case. It's going back to American Farm Bureau and Mississippi versus EPA. Those cases are on point here. In both of those cases, as here, EPA cited scientific uncertainty as an excuse for rejecting ecologically relevant secondary standards that were recommended by, that were developed by EPA staff and recommended by the Clean Air Science Advisory Committee, or CASAC. In both of those cases, this court nonetheless held that Section 109b2 plainly required EPA to take that step to specify a level of air quality requisite to protect public welfare. The only difference here is that instead of setting a secondary standard identical to the primary standard, EPA chose to do nothing. It chose to retain existing standards under which it acknowledges and actually concluded that harm is still occurring. Acid rain is still happening. Fish like brook trout are still dying in affected waters. Adirondack Mountain lakes, the Shenandoah Mountain streams, currently, a lot of them currently support only about half of the fish species that would otherwise be present.
In thinking about the scientific uncertainty, it's helped me to divide scientific uncertainty into two possible ways of thinking about it. One would be scientific uncertainty whether a stricter standard would alleviate acid rain problems at all, or in a manner improved over the current standard. That's one way to think about scientific uncertainty. The other way is we know that a stricter standard would help alleviate acid rain effects, but we have scientific uncertainty about where to draw the line. So I think your point is that this case is the second category, but if it were the first, that would be a sufficient basis for EPA not to act.
If I understand the first category correctly, that's I think that's along the lines that EPA is claiming, that they could not make a judgment as to whether the standard would even be protective.
Right.
That is contrary to the evidence before the agency.
Right.
Your point is that this is not the first case.
That would be the kind of case where EPA could decline to act.
We would say that because EPA would be acting in contravention of a clear statutory command, it would still bear a very heavy burden to,
right,
to deviate from that. Would actually have to show that anything it could do, based on the record in front of it, would necessarily have been arbitrary and capricious.
Right.
And that judgment has to be viewed through, and I'm going to sort of shift this into the second category,
yeah,
that judgment has to be viewed through the decades of case law in this court holding that the NAAQS program imposes on EPA a duty to act in the face of scientific uncertainty, even where it can't quantify the exact level of harm, it can't quantify the exact degree of protectiveness, even where it has to make judgments based on uncertain evidence. Congress indicated, Congress chose, to impose on EPA a duty to act in the face of that uncertainty. So in the second category, where EPA just is saying, well, we can't really draw the line as to how protective this standard is going to be, this court could not sustain its decision not to go forward in light of those standards.
Of course, if they had set one, they would have been challenged from the other side, saying it's inherently arbitrary to pick, you know, X over Y because there was no real scientific basis for picking X over Y.
Exactly. And interveners might be sitting here. We might be sitting over there. But the court would be
looking
at
that. But your answer to that is that our precedents and the statute require EPA to at least take a stab at something within the range of permissible outcomes.
Exactly. And in that case, EPA would be entitled to a great degree of deference in its technical judgments because EPA would be carrying out the statutory mandate, not departing from the statutory mandate. That's really the critical distinction in this case. So, and this just really goes to the fact that EPA can't carry that heavy burden on this record. We have a record here where the staff and the policy assessment developed a standard that it thought scientifically adequate to actually provide a range of protection against aquatic acidification. A range, the choices in the standard gave EPA a reasonable range to choose from minimally to substantially protective. It's a broad range. In case I characterize it as a broad range, but a reasonable range that gave EPA a very sound basis for being able to exercise its policy judgment as to what level of protection might be might be requisite. Staff in the KSAC gave EPA a sliding scale from which to choose. EPA's conclusion was that it could not tell what degree of protectiveness would be offered by one choice within that range as opposed to any other choice. It couldn't determine either the magnitude or the direction. That conclusion is just directly contrary to the evidence in front of the agency and to KSAC's recommendation. And for that reason, we've argued that the action is not only unlawful and arbitrary and capricious, but also that EPA has failed to explain itself in accordance with the requirements under law. EPA has the heaviest of obligations to explain itself in the NAAQS context. And in Mississippi versus EPA, this court described an added layer of stringency in that explanation when it's disagreeing with KSAC recommendation. The proposed rule acknowledged that KSAC recommended moving forward to establish a standard, and yet EPA never explained why the evidence that KSAC relied on was not adequate to, could not support the degree of confidence that KSAC placed in it. I mean, again, Mississippi versus EPA is informative here, is instructive, because KSAC was rendering a judgment based on the adequacy of the scientific information. EPA had a duty to respond in kind, and it didn't do that here. So given the clear statutory holding in American Farm Bureau in Mississippi, given EPA's clear duty to act in the face of uncertainty, given the undisputed fact that harm is still occurring from aquatic acidification, and given the strong scientific basis for adopting the standard here as developed by EPA staff and recommended by KSAC, we believe EPA's decision not to move forward was contrary to law and arbitrary and capricious. And unless you have further questions, I'll reserve the balance of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Dan Durkee from the U.S. Department of Justice. With me at council table is John Hannon from EPA's Office of General Counsel. Your Honor, I'd like to start with Judge Kavanaugh's, with your point about the types of uncertainty. I think the uncertainty here, I don't know if it's a third type, but it's a different type. And I think petitioners repeatedly in their reply brief and then for part of their argument today focus on a different part of the problem. Your Honor, you pointed out there's uncertainty that a stricter standard would help at all, and there's uncertainty about where to draw the line, for instance.
So it's not, just to interrupt you, sure. Sorry, but there's no uncertainty here that a stricter standard would help.
Right. EPA made the decision.
So why isn't that the end of the game?
Well, because the statutory language answers that. It doesn't say, as petitioners would read it, it doesn't say anytime a existing NAAQS is not requisite, you must revise. It says you must revise as appropriate in accordance with Section 109B.
But you know the current standard's not requisite, and you know some, I'm going to use the word stricter standard, mm-hmm. would be requisite. Why isn't it open and shut?
Well, there's a gap there.
You because you had a third category you wanted to get to. But
that is the third category. There's a slip between those two. It's first of all, it's not enough. We know under Farm Bureau in Mississippi, it's not enough just to say it's going to be better. It's going to be more protective. That is not sufficient. The problem that EPA grappled with and that the administrator decided she couldn't overcome is not should be 50 versus 75 or what the actual standard should be, but will this index, this form of the standard, this tool to get us there, will it actually hit what she selects, or will it be overprotective, or will it be underprotective, or where on the continuum?
But isn't the duty there to do the best you can once you know, mm-hmm. once you know that the current standard's not good enough, and you know some other standard would be good enough, and there's a range of possibilities, and you're worried that we're not going to hit exactly what we want to hit, you still have to do the best you can, I think, under the statute to choose within that range, right?
Well, we submit that there's an element of discretion and a judgment call about how close, how certain you need to be. Certainly, I don't think there's a bright line, right. but it's a continuum, and this is the third type of uncertainty. If within that continuum, if you can explain, as the administrator did, why she had insufficient confidence that it would be good enough, I think that that's an arbitrary and capricious standard that the court can look at and say, were the reasons explicitly given? Does the evidence in the record support it? and either affirm it or not.
Isn't there another element to your argument that you may be assuming we know? The statute uses the word requisite,
right,
and the courts have interpreted that to mean no more and no less than needed to cure whatever the difficulty is. Now, if you can't figure out where no more and no less is, then you're really in a bind in trying to comply with the statutory directive to in terms of what is requisite and what is not.
That's true, and that's what petitioners criticize. They say there is enough evidence to make that decision. That's the decision, though, about should the standard be a certain level, the second type of uncertainty. Is it requisite to protect at a level of 50 versus a level of 75 or whatever that is? But what the administrator was focusing on was a preliminary problem before you even get to that step. She said it doesn't make sense to make a decision that it should be 50 versus 75 or whatever because this tool that the staff has developed, this index, doesn't give me the confidence that I'll hit that number.
Could you explain while you're on that, you're looking at JA-120, and which is the final federal register notice. And so the bottom of the left column, top of the middle column, says the following. In this case, the uncertainties are arguably even greater than with an AAI-based standard, since as noted above, there's no demonstrable linkage between the elements of such standards and impacts on sensitive ecosystems that the standards would be intended to address. What's that mean?
That's what we're talking about. We know there's a problem, and
but
we know
the linkage part on a little bit.
The linkage between the standard allows a person to take ambient air quality concentrations and figure out how that translates into this concept of acid neutralizing capacity, which is the indicator for whether there's a real problem on the ground or not. And so the administrator would select a level for that, let's say 50 microequivalents per liter. That's protective. That's what I'm going to say is the requisite level. It's no higher, no less. The problem that she identifies here is the connection between setting that standard and actually achieving it. That this will this tool actually in practice get 50, or if I select 50 and say that's requisite, that's the requisite degree, and then we establish the regulation and people start applying it throughout the country, in some parts of the country, are they actually going to end up with 75? Or are they actually going to end up with 25? And so even though I can tell you 50 is the right, you know, no better, no worse, 50 is the right level, are we actually going to get that? That's what she was uncomfortable with. If she had better confidence, not that 50 versus 75 was the right answer, but that we'd actually get 50 if that's what I chose. That's why she couldn't proceed.
But wouldn't the right answer be to select 75, and if the tool, supposing you know 50, just to use your numbers, is not requisite, mm-hmm. because that's what the administrator said, in effect. So 75 we know would be better. We're uncertain whether we can hit 75, but shouldn't you try to hit 75 rather than just throwing up your hands and sticking with 50?
Well, again, I think I'd have two answers. One, it depends on the degree of uncertainty, which is going to be a record-based decision. If she didn't have any good reasons, she just felt like, you know, I just don't know, and there was nothing behind that, I think we'd have a hard time defending that. This is a different case. She explained the degree of uncertainty and why she felt that. But also she went further and said that, I might be misconstruing your point, but it's not the type of problem where you could just say, let's be more conservative. Let's raise the standard a little bit, and you know, so if we err, that's okay. Because the types of uncertainty that she identified, and the record goes into great detail about, are all over the board. It's not a situation where the uncertainties all point a certain way, so you could correct for that. There's no systemic bias in the system, in the calculations that say, well, we know we're erring on this
but
side.
But how do you know the current standard's not requisite?
Well, I think the bottom line answer, we know it's not requisite because the damage and the harms that are observed are still occurring, even at the current level of the standard.
But it would seem, okay.
So, I mean, in past cases, in fact, EPA probably would have said, well, we know there's a problem. We know we can address it. Let's at least do this. And, in fact, she proposed, well, at least let's make the standard more stringent and set it at the primary, the health-based standard, because that'll at least help. I think the phrase was it will directionally benefit. It'll get us in the right direction. But the commentators universally almost rejected that, and I think that would be contrary to the court's precedent in Farm Bureau, because if you – and this is where we disagree with plaintiffs on what Farm Bureau and Mississippi means. We see Farm Bureau and Mississippi as saying if you set a standard, you have to determine that target, what is requisite degree. Because if you don't have that target, then there's no way to judge the reasonableness. And that was the problem in Farm Bureau was CASAC, the Scientific Advisory Committee, recommended a particular level. And EPA said, no, we're not going to do that level. We're just going to set it at a different level. And the court said, no, you can't do that because you don't, without saying your level is requisite, how do you compare what CASAC said is requisite? That was the discontinuity.
Two questions. First of all, was there evidence that what we call acid rain was actually beneficial in some instances?
There's, in one context, there is evidence, and that's it's called nutrient enrichment. Acid rain is basically sulfur oxides and nitrogen oxides, and in some situations, in some environments, additional nitrogen actually can be considered beneficial. It's like fertilizer. It can help certain systems like, I'm not sure what the specifics are, but it's not necessarily adverse to introduce additional nitrogen to certain environments.
Okay. Well, you're just talking now about water, right? As opposed to land?
I think certain aquatic environments, right? That's not saying it's acidifying it. It's saying it's adding more nutrients to it.
I seem to recall something to the effect that higher altitude streams and lakes, ponds, whatever, are more susceptible to adverse consequences from acid rain. Why is that?
It depends. It's because of an ecosystem's reaction to acid rain depends on a number of factors. What's called base cations, the nature of the soil, its ability to neutralize acid has an effect. The runoff within the watershed has an effect. So I don't think it's necessarily that it's a higher elevation. It's the topography and the type of soil and other ecological factors that are in, for instance, the Adirondacks or the Cascades. Yeah. I'm not sure that it's actually – I don't think the elevation necessarily is the key, though. But there are different there are sensitive regions, there are less sensitive regions, and that's one of the things that the administrator was concerned about, was that a lot of the data, most of the data is, not surprisingly, collected from sensitive regions, the regions where we have the biggest problem. That's where the data is collected. And CASAC echoed this concern that, well, if you use those numbers and you base what your standard is on the most sensitive, and you don't have a good grasp that's going to be representative of the entire area or all the ecosystems, you're in danger of being biased one way or the other.
Is the idea you have 84 eco regions and you would set a different number for each eco region?
There'd be one national number. Let's say it's 50. There'd be one national number that the administrator would decide is the requisite degree of protection for acid neutralizing capacity, and that would apply across
the country. Because this has to be a national standard.
Exactly.
So it has to be uniform? Is a national standard always uniform?
It's uniform in the degree of protection it applies in saying that acid neutralizing capacity below 50 is not requisite to protect. But the way the index would be set up allows each region to tailor based on its specific characteristics. So the index, it's these F factors, F1, F2, F3. One of those factors incorporates the national standard, which doesn't change. The other factors are region specific. so that based on the sensitivity, the existing sensitivity of the region, the concentrations of the pollutants in the air, what's called the critical loading, the runoff that I talked about, all those would be factored into the equation so that you get a regional specific.
Who is making that calculation?
EPA would EPA in investigating this investigated some potential numbers, but EPA would set the national number, yeah. And then for each equal region, if you wanted to say, am I in compliance or not, you'd be able in each region the air quality managers would be able to plug in the numbers and say, you could solve it either way. You could either say, all right, I know what my target is, what's the level
now,
of
who is it that's making this request? Who is saying am I in compliance or not?
Well, I think, if an act were adopted, then states or counties or whatever the correct geographical boundary for NAAQS compliance.
You know, EPA would make, ask if they were in compliance?
Well, EPA would make a decision whether you're in attainment or not in attainment with this new secondary NAAQS, okay. Just like any other.
What sort of industries generate the nitrogen oxides and sulfur oxides?
I don't know, Your Honor. I'm not sure.
Paper, pulp?
I really don't know. I imagine that's probably in the record, but...
I looked for it. I couldn't find it.
Okay.
Pulp and paper, is that one of the generators? Or
I would just be guessing. I don't know. I know that what they focused on was the effects of oxides of sulfur and oxides of nitrogen, which come in different forms, but... I think there is a chart, and I'm not sure I could put my fingers on it quickly, about the nature of the problem in the staff paper. I believe there's a chart that breaks down the contribution of sulfur versus the contribution of nitrogen, and I think that chart also gets into east versus western part of the United States and types of industry, such as electrical utilities, and I believe the biggest generator is electrical utilities, and I think sulfur has twice as much an effect of as nitrogen, and there's more of a problem in the east than the west, and I'm not sure I can point to you in the JA where that table is, but it's in what's called the PA or the staff paper, and
we'll take a look at it.
Okay.
Before you sit down, would you in a nutshell give me your version of or your statutory interpretation that you're relying on? Is it the D,
9D.
D. You're relying on D, is that as appropriate? Is it?
Yes, we're relying on D. And in our brief, we quote D and B. In our brief at page 6, we quote 7409D1, the administrator shall make such revisions in such criterion standards and promulgate such new standards as may be appropriate in accordance with 7408 and subsection B. So it's the as may be appropriate that we're focusing on.
What is the meaning of that in your view?
Well, the meaning of that, first as may be appropriate is limited by B, which is the requisite language. There's precedent that says, for instance, you can't say, well, it's going to be really expensive, so it's inappropriate. So the scope of what's appropriate is limited by the revision has to achieve the requisite degree of protection. But we say that does not answer the question. There's still an ambiguity about, well, what if you can't either determine the requisite degree of protection, you can't determine whether any degree that you select will actually be achieved. That's the ambiguity that the administrator focused on and that I think the petitioners ignore, because they want to read out as may be appropriate and say, as Judge Kavanaugh, as you alluded to, their argument is, if there's a problem, if the standard needs to be revised because it's not doing the job, you have to revise it. We say there's discretion built into the statute because Congress used the phrase as may be appropriate. That has to mean something. And it can't mean anything.
But I think my problem here, and I might plow some of the same ground here, but my problem here is if there are uncertainty about whether the current standard is requisite, okay, that's a far easier case for EPA.
Right.
But EPA itself said, we know that the current standard is not requisite to protect the public welfare. That's a problem then, and we know that some stricter standard would be better at protecting the public welfare. We just can't tell where, how much stricter.
Again, not necessarily how
and
much
the problem
stricter.
I have with that, I guess, is just thinking about a lot of these cases. Why couldn't EPA say that in just about every case? Because it's always uncertain. There's kind of a faux certainty going on with some of these cases. I mean, it's always uncertain where exactly to set the standard, right? And so EPA in every case could say, we know the current standard is not requisite, but it's uncertain whether to do 50 or 75, therefore we're going to keep it at 25. That's a problem.
Right.
So what's the answer to that problem?
I think that's where we turn to the merits arguments about, well, why did the administrator say it was uncertain, and is there record support for it, and how strong is that support, and does it really address the uncertainty? For instance, if the administrator's reasons for uncertainty were just that the studies are mixed, you can't tell. There's studies on both sides. It's a scientific uncertainty. That would be one problem. But she pointed to a more fundamental problem, like we discussed, that it's not a matter of is it a big problem or a little problem or will this help or not, or will a different level help or not. It's not will it help or not. We're not talking about whether a more stringent standard will help or not. We're talking about, will we actually get that? Because if she felt that if she
get
went ahead,
what? Will we actually get that, you said?
The requisite degree of protection. Let's say a level of 50 micro equivalents per liter. That's how it's expressed.
The current. That's what I'm saying, the same thing. You know the current's not requisite. And so I can't see how you can say, we know the current standard's not requisite, but we're going to stick with it. I mean, that's...
Well, it's because I think you need to compare to, well, what would she do? And I think petitioners want you to be thinking that there's this alternative that she could select that would be... address the problem.
Well, I think what they are saying is there are a range of possible alternatives, but we know the current one is no good.
Right. But again, what they're saying is there's a range of possible alternatives of where you land. Think of it as a bullseye. Requisite, the standard, what's requisite, no more or less, is a bullseye.
Mm-hmm.
And they're saying, well, you don't have to hit the 10 circle.
Right.
You could hit the 9 circle. The KSAC committee said, you could choose between 8 and 10, and you're still going to be requisite. So there's uncertainty there. You can account for it. You can handle it. But just choose something in the bullseye. And the case law says you have to aim at the bullseye at least. Mm-hmm. What the administrator is saying is, no, we don't have the tool that get us there. If the tool to get to the bullseye is this index, and if I adopt the index as a tool, I'm not sure if I'm going to hit 8, 9, 10, or maybe 1 or 2.
Right, you're going to hit the board.
Well, but
you know you're not going to with the current standard.
That's true. You know you're not to. But here's where it's a judgment call by the administrator. The administrator said, even if I hit the board, I want to be sure that I'm at least hitting in the 8, 9, or 10. Hitting the 1 or the 2 is going to be so different from what is requisite that I don't think
it's still better than the current.
Well, again, I think I'm not saying the administrator couldn't choose that, but she would be subject to a challenge from the other side to say,
enough. The administrator couldn't choose what?
Couldn't go forward anyway and say, I'm willing to live with this uncertainty that I might hit the 1 or the 2 instead of the 8 or the 9. There's that uncertainty.
Again, you're answering a different question than the one I understand Judge Kavanaugh to be asking. Is the fact that there is uncertainty when you know for certain that the current standard is not meeting requisite, is the fact that there's uncertainty a good enough reason to not do anything as opposed to doing the best you can to sort out something?
And I think there's a sliding scale. I think that you could certainly say in some cases that uncertainty would not be enough. But here, I think the administrator has given sufficient reasons why the uncertainty is so great and the nature of the uncertainty is so great that it is sufficient. And I would like to say, I see my time is up. I would like to remind the court, it's not like the administrator is doing nothing. She decided not to adopt the standard now, but she didn't do nothing. She adopted this pilot program at the end of the rulemaking to a demonstration pilot program. She has this is admittedly outside the record, but it's a 5-year review. The next review was actually supposed to commence last week, and I think the funding issue, the appropriations lapse has thrown that in out of whack as many things. But the administrator is still reviewing this. She didn't close the door on it. She didn't say, I am not going to use this.
Well, I mean, that, like a lot of these cases, that shows that the administrator is making a sound policy decision, but that's really not relevant to our focus on the precise text and context of this case.
I think the relevance is that that the administrator is proceeding in a stepwise fashion. And the history of this type of regulation shows that the administrator has been, EPA has been struggling with how to handle these welfare effects for a long time.
Yeah.
And the science has improved, and we also dispute with petitioners, well, what did CASAC really say? And I think one thing we agree on is CASAC and EPA found that the science has improved, and the tools to address this problem have improved. And the administrator didn't say, I'm throwing this out, we're going to have to start over. She said, I want to refine this. I want more data.
Was the problem lack of data?
That was one of the problems. That is probably the primary problem.
What is EPA doing to gather the data, gather more data?
Well, the data primarily comes not from EPA, but from other entities, from states that collect water quality data, from private entities like educational institutions that go out and make studies. The administrator explained that more data, especially more water quality data, would help her get a better understanding of whether these levels that she selects, these critical loads of pollutants, are really representative across an ecosystem, especially where there's ecosystems with very little data, like in the western United States, where the data is much sparser. More data isn't necessarily a panacea. It won't necessarily solve the problem. It won't necessarily, without data, it doesn't mean she couldn't proceed without data, but she said, if I had more data, that would give me a better feel that these numbers I'm choosing are representative.
This is not just the rulemaking that was conducted was not just confined to aquatic environments, was it?
The only thing that, the problem is not confined to aquatic. The problem that EPA identified affects terrestrial also, and she did find that there's adverse welfare impacts to aquatic and terrestrial environments. That there's basically four injuries. Aquatic environments are acidifying, terrestrial environments are acidifying, and both aquatic and terrestrial have this nutrient enrichment problem. So different types of environments, different types of problems.
When the rulemaking talks about dry depositions,
yes.
That means that the nitrogen oxide is falling on the land not through rain, but just as a result of the having been in the atmosphere. Is that what that
means? Yeah,
right. Not necessarily on the land, but it could be into the water. But yeah, that would be distinct. Wet deposition is basically rain, fog, snow.
Okay.
So it can precipitate out without. That's a bad word.
Wherever there is coal burned, there's going to be deposition of the material somewhere. And if
right.
It isn't precipitation to take it down, it's going to get there by itself.
Right. It'll fall out of the atmosphere in different forms. That's right.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. There's quite a bit I could address, but I'll try to just hit a couple of things. EPA is focused on a lot of back and forth was about uncertainty, and each of the uncertainties that were discussed by EPA or cited by EPA as debilitating were actually addressed in the policy assessment by staff. There were 12 specific types of uncertainty that were looked at. Staff concluded that the influence of 10 of them was low, one of them was medium. One of them was medium-high, but as to that one, the direction was known, and there was a way it would have been too conservative a standard, and EPA would have had a choice there to adjust the standard in such a way to accommodate it. EPA never explained why That was wrong. There's a concern about the representativeness of water quality data that they've raised in each within ecoregions. In other words, a concern about being overprotective within an ecoregion. The policy assessment said that if you had data on 10 or more water bodies within an ecoregion, you could get a representative sampling. You could make a choice as to what level of protection to set within that ecoregion. Only 12 ecoregions didn't have that data. All of them were not sensitive to acidic deposition. EPA never explained in the Federal Register notice or in the brief why this was wrong. Similar with base cation supply, with runoff rate, with deposition of reduced nitrogen, each and every one of the uncertainties that EPA says in combination are so great that they can't make any reasoned judgment, that they can't pick any level whatsoever, can't know where on the target they're going to hit. All of these things were dealt with by the policy assessment. They were reviewed by KSAC, and KSAC nonetheless recommended going forward. EPA's reading of Farm Bureau of Mississippi is, we disagree with that reading. EPA says that the mandatory duty to choose a requisite level only applies when EPA chooses to set a standard, and if they don't choose to set a standard, then they have no duty to choose a requisite level. But that would strip the key mandatory requirement of Section 109b2, the protection of the public welfare, right out of the statute. The same problem with their reliance on appropriate. Appropriate is in the statute. It doesn't just say judgment as appropriate. It says appropriate in accordance with Section 109b2. This court in American Trucking 1 held that in accordance with simply imports the mandatory requirements of 109b2 into the revision process under 109d. EPA still has to show that it could make no reasoned judgment as to a requisite level, whether it's in the context of a revision or in the first instance under 109b. There's no ambiguity. A statute doesn't become ambiguous simply because it doesn't say what the agency should do if it chooses not to follow the statute. If that were the case, there would be no such thing as a clear command of Congress. There would be no such thing as a clear statutory command. Finally, all we're saying is that EPA has to exercise its judgment here. Given the record, given the court's case law, given Congress's choice to require action in the face of uncertainty, EPA has to shoot the arrow, and it had a sound scientific basis here
your bottom line
to do
is that.
That
if the current standard is not doing the job, EPA has to revise it.
EPA has to specify a requisite level unless it would be arbitrary and capricious to do so. And here what we're saying is that the record was such, the evidence in the record was such, KSAC's recommendation was such, that not setting a standard, despite the fact that harm was occurring, despite the fact that the current standards are not requisite, that decision to stay, EPA's decision to stay its hand was in fact arbitrary and capricious and contrary to law.
So EPA looks at a standard, secondary or primary, whatever, and EPA thinks the evidence shows that it could be improved. EPA has no discretion; it has to revise it.
There's no discretion under the statute, Your Honor. I think the statute is very clear. Shall specify a level requisite to protect public welfare. EPA is claiming.
This court's opinion because it came out too late and it was decided. Well, maybe you did. Did you cite the National Environmental Defense or Development Association case?
No, Your Honor, we didn't cite that case.
Are you familiar with that case? It's 686 Bed 3rd, 813, or no, 803. And Judge Santel wrote the opinion, and it says, the Clean Air Act gives EPA significant discretion to decide whether to revise NAAQS. And that's an interpretation of the American Trucking.
Your Honor, I'm sorry, I'm not familiar enough with the case to be able to distinguish it here, but under...
It was
under
a revision of the national standard for sulfur dioxide.
For sulfur dioxide. I think for us the key decisions remain American Farm Bureau in Mississippi, where the court held that there is a clear statutory duty to at least specify a requisite level. If I remember the sulfur, I can't speak to that, but I shouldn't go out on a limb and speak to that's the case because I'm not familiar with it.
What's unusual in this case, I think, is that EPA has set the current standard is not requisite.
That's correct, Your Honor. I think that is the
That's the big headline of the briefs.
Right.
So,
unless there's anything else, thank you very much.
Thank you.